Ah, good evening. I was just on my way home from the mayor's office and thought I'd stop here at Red Dragon and have a pipe or three. Chasing the dragon's tail, as they are wont to say. The mayor was in a singular state today. Quite unreasonable. I don't understand how he expects me to be his personal advisor if he won't let me advise him. Perhaps I shall make that four balls after all. Do you indulge? No. You should try it. There's no harm to it. Look at that poor little fool over there. He hasn't moved from that bed for 3 days now. He certainly isn't harming anyone. Nothing wrong with a little pipe dream now and then. Tonight's tale will be read to you by Mr. Emerson Lighthouse, who is certainly no stranger to the pipe. I rarely see him in this establishment, however. He seems to prefer his hookah with its sweet leaf to the infamous poppy. I have been trying to discover the source of his supply for some time, to no avail. Perhaps that is what they are putting in the punch at the gangplank these days. Business is booming since the introduction of that concoction. But I hear they are still running deeply in the red. If they aren't careful, they may find their delightful little public house going up in smoke. Rumor has it that those so-called bohemians are planning a vacation for themselves in the northern mountains. If you were to ask your humble host for his exalted opinion, I would be forced to admit that they are more likely intending on slipping away into the night on the run from their creditors. It's certainly what I would do.
The New Accelerator by H.G. Wells. Certainly, if ever a man found a guinea when he was looking for a pin, it is my good friend Professor Gibbern. I have heard before of investigators overshooting the mark, but never quite to the extent that he has done. He has really, this time at any rate, without any touch of exaggeration, found something to revolutionize human life. And that, when he was simply seeking an all-around nervous stimulant to bring languid people up to the stresses of these pushful days. I have tasted the stuff myself several times, and I cannot do better than describe the effect the thing had on me. That there are astonishing experiences in store for all in search of new sensations will become apparent enough. Professor Gibbern, as many people know, is my neighbor in Folkestone. Unless my memory plays me a trick, his portrait at various ages has already appeared in the Strand magazine, I think late in 1899. But I am unable to look it up because I have lent that volume to someone who has never sent it back. The reader may, perhaps, recall the high forehead and the singularly long black eyebrows that give such a Mephistophelian touch to his face. He occupies one of those pleasant little detached houses in the mixed style that make the western end of the Upper Sandgate Road so interesting. His is the one with the Flemish gables and the Moorish portico, and it is in the little room with the mullioned bay window that he works when he is down here, and in which, of an evening, we have so often smoked and talked together. He is a mighty jester, but, besides, he likes to talk to me about his work. He is one of those men who find help and stimulus in talking, and so I have been able to follow the conception of the New Accelerator right up from a very early stage. Of course, The greater portion of his experimental work is not done in Folkestone, but in Gower Street, in the fine new laboratory next to the hospital that he has been the first to use. As everyone knows, or at least as all intelligent people know, the field of study in which Gibbern has gained so great and deserved a reputation among physiologists is the action of drugs upon the nervous system. Upon soporifics, sedatives, and anesthetics, he is, I am told, unequaled. He is also a chemist of considerable eminence, and, I suppose, in the subtle and complex jungle of riddles that centers both the ganglion cell and the axis fiber, there are little cleared places of his making, little glades of illumination that, until he sees fit to publish his results, are still inaccessible to every other living man. And in the last few years, he has been particularly assiduous upon this question of nervous stimulants, and already, before the discovery of the new accelerator, very successful with them. Medical science has to thank him for at least three distinct and absolutely safe invigorators of unrivaled value to practicing men. In cases of exhaustion, the preparation known as Gibbern's B syrup has, I suppose, saved more lives already than any lifeboat round the coast. "But none of these little things begins to satisfy me yet," he told me nearly a year ago. "Either they increase the central energy without affecting the nerves, or simply increase the available energy by lowering nervous conductivity, and all of them are unequal and local in their operation. One wakes up the heart and viscera and leaves the brain stupefied. Another gets the brain champagne fashion and does nothing good for the solar plexus. What I want, and what, if it's an earthly possibility I mean to have, is a stimulant that stimulates all around, that wakes you up for a time from the crown of your head to the tip of your great toe. It makes you go two or even three to everybody else's one, eh? That's the thing I am after." "It would tire a man," I said. "Not a doubt of it, and you'd eat double or triple and all that. But just think what the thing would mean. Imagine yourself with a little vial like this." He held up a little bottle of green glass and emphasized his points with it. "In this precious vial is the power to think twice as fast, move twice as quickly, do twice as much work in a given time as you could otherwise do." "But is such a thing possible?" I asked. "Now I believe so. If it isn't, I've wasted my time for a year. These various preparations of the hypophosphites, for example, seem to show that something of the sort, even if it was only 1.5 times as fast, it would do." "Oh, it would do," I said. "If you were a statesman at a corner, for example, time rushing up against you, something urgent to be done, eh? He could dose his private secretary," I said, "and gain double time. And think if you, for example, wanted to finish a book. Usually," I said, "I wish I'd never begun them. Or a doctor, driven to death, wants to sit down and think out a case. Or a barrister, or a man cramming for an examination. Worth a guinea a drop," said I, "and more to men like that." "And in a duel," said Gibbern, "where all depends on your quickness in pulling the trigger." "Or fencing," I echoed. "You see? If I get it as an all-around thing, it will really do you no harm at all, except perhaps to an infinitesimal degree it brings you nearer old age. You will just have lived twice to other people's once." "I suppose," I meditated, "in a duel. Would it be fair?" "That's a question for seconds," said Gibbern. I harked back further. "And you really think such a thing is possible?" I said. "As possible," said Gibbern, glancing at something that went throbbing by the window, "as a motor bus. As a matter of fact..." He paused and smiled at me deeply and tapped slowly on the edge of his desk with the green file. "I think I know the stuff. Already I've got something coming." The nervous smile upon his face betrayed the gravity of his revelation. He rarely talked of his actual experimental work unless things were very near the end. "And it may be, I shouldn't be surprised, it may even do the thing with a greater rate than twice." "It will be a rather big thing," I hazarded. "It will be," said he, "a rather big thing." But I don't think he quite knew what a big thing it was to be, for all that. I remember we had several talks about the stuff after that. The new accelerator, he called it, and his tone about it grew more confident on each occasion. Sometimes he talked nervously of unexpected physiological results its use might have, and then he would get a little unhappy. At others, he was frankly mercenary, and we debated long and anxiously how the preparation might be turned to a commercial account. "It's a good thing," said Gibbon, "a tremendous thing. I know I am giving the world something, and I think it only reasonable we should expect the world to pay. The dignity of science is all very well, but I think somehow I must have the monopoly on stuff for, say, 10 years. I don't see why all the fun in life should go to the dealers in ham." My own interest in the coming drug certainly did not wane in the time. I have always had a queer little twist towards metaphysics in my mind. I have always been given to the paradoxes of space and time, and it seemed to me that Gibbon was really preparing no less than the absolute acceleration of life. Suppose a man repeatedly dosed with such a preparation. He would live an active and record life indeed, but he would be an adult at 11, middle-aged at 25, and by 30 well on the road to senile decay. The marvel of drugs has always been great to my mind. You can madden a man, calm a man, make him incredibly strong and alert, or a helpless log, quicken this passion and allay that, all by means of drugs. And here was a new miracle to be added to the strange armory of files the doctors use. But Gibbon was far too eager upon his technical points to enter very keenly into my aspect of the question. It was the 7th or 8th of August when he told me the distillation that would decide his failure or success for a time was going forward as we talked. And it was on the 10th that he told me the thing was done and the new accelerator a tangible reality in the world. I met him as I was going up the Sandgate Hill towards Folkestone. I think I was going to get my hair cut, and he came hurrying down to meet me. I suppose he was coming to my house to tell me at once of his success. I remember that his eyes were unusually bright and his face flushed, and I noted even then the swift alacrity of his step. "It's done," he cried, and gripped my hand, speaking very fast. "It's more than done. Come up to my house and see." "Really?" "Really," he shouted, "incredibly. Come up and see." "And it does twice?" "It does more, much more. It scares me. Come up and see the stuff. Taste it. Try it. It's the most amazing stuff on earth." He gripped my arm, and walking at such a pace that he forced me into a trot, went shouting with me up the hill. A whole charabang full of people turned and stared at us in unison, after the manner of people in charabangs. It was one of those hot, clear days that Folkestone sees so much of. Every color incredibly bright, and every outline hard. There was a breeze, of course, but not such a breeze as sufficed under these conditions to keep me cool and dry. I panted for mercy. "I'm not walking fast, am I?" cried Gibbon, and slackened his pace to a quick march. "You've been taking some of this stuff," I puffed. "No," he said. "At the utmost, a drop of water that stood in a beaker from which I had washed out the last traces of the stuff. I did take some last night, you know, but that's ancient history now." "And it goes twice as fast," I said, nearing his doorway in a grateful perspiration. "It goes 1,000 times, many 1,000 times, cried Gibbon, with dramatic gesture, flinging open his early English carved oak gate. "Phew," said I, and followed him to the door. "I don't know how many times it goes," he said, with his latch key in hand. "It throws all sorts of light on nervous physiology. It kicks the theory of vision into a perfectly no shape. Heaven knows how many 1,000 times. We'll test all that after. The thing is to try the stuff now." "Try the stuff," I said, as we went along the passage. "Rather," said Gibbon, turning on me in his study. "There it is, in that little green file over there. Unless you happen to be afraid." I'm a careful man by nature, and only theoretically adventurous. I was afraid. But on the other hand, there is pride. "Well," I haggled, "you say you've tried it?" "I've tried it," he said, "and I don't look hurt, do I? I don't even look very livery, and I feel..." I sat down. "Give me the potion," I said. "If the worst comes to the worst, it will save me having my hair cut. And that, I think, is one of the most hateful duties of a civilized man. How do you take the mixture?" "With water," said Gibbon, whacking down a carafe. He stood up in front of his desk and regarded me in his easy chair. His manner was suddenly affected by a touch of the Harley Street specialist. "It's rum stuff, you know," he said. I made a gesture with my hand. "I must warn you, as soon as you've got it down, shut your eyes and open them very cautiously in a minute or so's time. One still sees. The sense of vision is a question of length of vibration and not of multitude of impacts. But there's a kind of shock to the retina. A nasty, giddy confusion just at the time if the eyes are open. Keep them shut." "Shut," I said. "Good. And the next thing is, keep still. Don't begin to whack about. You may fetch something, a nasty rap, if you do. Remember, you will be going several thousand times faster than you ever did before. Heart, lungs, muscles, brain, everything. And you will hit hard without knowing it. You won't know it, you know. You'll feel just as you do now. Only everything in the world will seem to be going ever so many thousand times slower than it ever went before. That's what makes it so queer." "Lord," I said, "and you mean..." "You'll see," he said, and took up a little measure. He glanced at the material on his desk. "Glasses," he said, "water, all here. Mustn't take too much for the first attempt." The little phial glucked out its precious contents. "Don't forget what I told you," he said, pouring the contents of the measure into a glass in the manner of an Italian waiter measuring whiskey. "Sit with the eyes tightly shut and in absolute stillness for 2 minutes," he said. "Then you will hear me speak." He added an inch or so of water to the little dose in each glass. "By the by," he said, "don't put your glass down. Keep it in your hand and rest your hand on your knee. Yes, just so." He raised his glass. "The new accelerator," I said. "The new accelerator," he answered, and we touched glasses and drank, and instantly, I closed my eyes. You know that blank non-existence into which one drops when one has taken gas? For an indefinite interval, it was like that. Then, I heard Gibbern telling me to wake up, and I stirred and opened my eyes. There he stood, as he had been standing, glass still in hand. It was empty. That was all the difference. "Well," said I. "Nothing out of the way?" "Nothing. A slight feeling of exhilaration, perhaps. Nothing more." "Sounds?" he asked. "Things are still," I said. "By Jove, yes, they are still. Except the sort of faint patter like rain falling on different things. What is that?" "Analyzed sounds, I think," he said. "But I'm not sure." He glanced at the window. "Have you ever seen a curtain in front of a window fixed in that way before?" I followed his eyes, and there was the end of the curtain, frozen as it were, corner high in the act of flapping briskly in the breeze. "No," said I, "that's odd." "And here," he said, and opened the hand that held the glass. Naturally, I winced, expecting the glass to smash. But so far from smashing, it did not even seem to stir. It hung in midair, motionless. "Roughly speaking," said Gibbern, "an object in these latitudes falls 16 feet in the first second. This glass is falling 16 feet in a second now. Only, you see, it hasn't been falling yet for 1/100th part of a second. That gives you some idea of the pace of my accelerator." And he waved his hand round and round over and under the slowly sinking glass. Finally, he took it by the bottom, pulled it down, and placed it very carefully on the table. "Eh?" he said to me, and laughed. "That seems all right," I said, and began very gingerly to raise myself from my chair. I felt perfectly well, very light and comfortable, and quite confident in my mind. I was going fast all over. My heart, for example, was beating 1,000 times a second, but that caused me no discomfort at all. I looked out the window. An immovable cyclist, head down, with a frozen puff of dust behind his driving wheel, scorched to overtake a galloping charabanc that did not stir. I gaped in amazement at this incredible spectacle. "Gibbern," I cried, "how long will this confounded stuff last?" "Heaven knows," he answered. "Last time I took it, I went to bed and slept it off. I tell you, I was frightened. It must have lasted some minutes, I think. It seemed like hours. But after a bit, it slows down rather suddenly, I believe." I was proud to observe that I did not feel frightened. I suppose because there were two of us. "Why shouldn't we go out?" I asked. "Why not?" he smiled. "Oh, But they'll see us, I said. Not they. Goodness no. Well, we shall be going 1,000 times faster than the quickest conjuring trick that was ever done. Come along. Which way shall we go? Window or door? And out by the window we went. Assuredly, of all the strange experiences that I have ever had or imagined, or read of other people having or imagining, that little raid I made with Gibbern on the Folkestone Lees under the influence of the new accelerator was the strangest and maddest of all. We went out by his gate into the road, and there we made a minute examination of the statuesque passing traffic. The tops of the wheels and some of the legs of the horses of this charabang, the end of the whiplash and the lower jaw of the conductor, who was just beginning to yawn, were perceptibly in motion, but all the rest of this lumbering conveyance seemed still and quiet, quite noiseless, except for the faint rattling that came from one man's throat. And, as parts of this frozen edifice, there were a driver, you know, and a conductor, and 11 people. The effect as we walked about the thing began by being madly queer and ended by being disagreeable. There they were, people like ourselves and yet not like ourselves, frozen in careless attitudes, caught mid-gesture. A girl and a man smiled at one another, a leering smile that threatened to last evermore. A woman in a floppy capeline rested her arm on the rail and stared at Gibbern's house with the unwinking stare of eternity. A man stroked his mustache like a wax figure, and another stretched a tiresome stiff hand with extended fingers towards his loosened hat. We stared at them. We laughed at them. We made faces at them. And then a sort of disgust of them came upon us, and we turned away and walked around the front of the cyclist toward the Lees. Goodness, cried Gibbern suddenly, look there. He pointed, and there, at the tip of his finger, and sliding down the air with wings flapping slowly at the speed of an exceptionally languid snail, was a bee. And so we came out upon the Lees. There, the thing seemed madder than ever. The band was playing in the upper stand, though all the sound it made for us was a low-pitched, wheezy rattle, a sort of prolonged last sigh that passed at times into a sound like the slow, muffled ticking of some monstrous clock. Frozen people stood erect. Strange, silent, self-conscious-looking dummies hung unstably in mid-stride, promenading across the grass. I passed close to a little poodle dog suspended in the act of leaping and watched the slow movement of his legs as he sank to earth. Lord, look here, cried Gibbern, and we halted for a moment before a magnificent person in a white, faint-striped flannels, white shoes, and a Panama hat, who turned to look back and wink at two gaily dressed ladies he had just passed. A wink, studied with such leisurely deliberation as we could afford, is an unattractive thing. It loses any quality of alert gaiety, and one remarks that the winking eye does not completely close, that under its drooping lid appears the lower edge of an eyeball, and a little line of white. Heaven give me memory, said I, and I will never wink again. Or a smile, said Gibbern, with his eye on the lady's answering teeth. It's infernally hot somehow, said I. Let's go slower. Oh, come along, said Gibbern. We picked our way among the chairs in the path. Many of the people sitting in the chairs seemed almost natural in their passive poses. But the contorted scarlet of the bandsman was not a restful thing to see. A purple-faced little gentleman was frozen in the midst of a violent struggle to refold his newspaper against the wind. There were many evidences that all these people, in their sluggish way, were exposed to a considerable breeze, a breeze that had no existence so far as our sensations went. We came out and walked a little way from the crowd and turned and regarded it. To see all that multitude change to a picture, smitten rigid as it were, into the semblance of realistic wax was impossibly wonderful. It was absurd, of course, but it filled me with an irrational and exultant sense of superior advantage. Consider the wonder of it. All that I had said and thought and done since the stuff had begun to work in my veins had happened so far as those people, so far as the world in general went, in the twinkling of an eye. The new accelerator, I began, but Gibbern interrupted me. "There's that infernal old woman," he said. "What old woman?" "Lives next door to me," said Gibbern. "Has a lapdog that yaps. Gods, the temptation is strong." There was something very boyish and impulsive about Gibbern at times. Before I could expostulate with him, he had dashed forward, snatched the unfortunate animal out of visible existence, and was running violently with it towards the Cliff of the Lees. It was most extraordinary. The little brute, you know, didn't bark or wriggle or make the slightest sign of vitality. It kept quite stiffly in an attitude of somnolent repose, and Gibbern held it by the neck. It was like running about with a dog of wood. "Gibbern," I cried, "put it down!" Then I said something else. "If you run like that, Gibbern," I cried, "you'll set your clothes on fire. Your linen trousers are going brown as it is." He clapped his hand on his thigh and stood hesitating on the verge. "Gibbern," I cried, coming up, "put it down. This heat is too much. It's our running. 2 or 3 miles a second. Friction of the air." "What?" he said, glancing at the dog. "Friction of the air," I shouted. "Friction of the air. Going too fast, like meteorites and things. Too hot. And Gibbern, Gibbern, I'm all over prickling and a sort of perspiration. You can see people stirring slightly. I believe the stuff is wearing off. Put that dog down." "Eh?" he said. "It's working off," I repeated. "We're too hot and the stuff's working off. I'm wet through." He stared at me, then at the band, the wheezy rattle of whose performance was certainly going faster. Then, with a tremendous sweep of his arm, he hurled the dog away from him, and it went spinning upward, still inanimate, and hung at last over the grouped parasols of a knot of chattering people. Gibbern was gripping my elbow. "By Jove!" he cried. "I believe it is. A sort of hot pricking. And yes, that man's moving his pocket handkerchief. Perceptibly. We must get out of this sharp." But we could not get out of it sharply enough. Luckily, perhaps, for we might have run, and if we had run, we should, I believe, have burst into flames. Almost certainly we should have burst into flames. You know, we had neither of us thought of that. But before we could even begin to run, the action of the drug had ceased. It was the business of a minute fraction of a second. The effect of the new accelerator passed like the drawing of a curtain, vanished in the movement of a hand. I heard Gibbern's voice in infinite alarm. "Sit down," he said, and flopped down upon the turf at the edge of the lees I sat, scorching as I sat. There is a patch of burnt grass there still where I sat down. The whole stagnation seemed to wake up as I did so. The disarticulated vibration of the band rushed together in a blast of music. The promenaders put their feet down and walked their ways. The papers and flags began flapping. Smiles passed into words. The winker finished his wink and went on his way complacently, and all the seated people moved and spoke. The whole world had come alive again, was going as fast as we were. Or rather, we were going no faster than the rest of the world. It was like slowing down as one comes into a railway station. Everything seemed to spin around for a second or two. I had the most transient feeling of nausea, and that was all. And the little dog, which had seemed to hang for a moment when the force of Gibbern's arm was expended, fell with a swift acceleration, clean through a lady's parasol. That was the saving of us. Except for one corpulent old gentleman in a lawn chair, who certainly did start at the sight of us, and afterwards regarded us at intervals with a darkly suspicious eye, and finally, I believe, said something to his nurse about us, I doubt if anyone else noticed our sudden appearance among them. We must have appeared abruptly. We ceased to smolder almost at once, though the turf beneath me was uncomfortably hot. The attention of everyone, including even the Amusements Association band, which on this occasion, for the only time in its history, got out of tune, was arrested by the amazing fact, and still more amazing yapping and uproar caused by the fact that a respectable, overfed lapdog sleeping quietly to the east of the bandstand should suddenly fall through the parasol of a lady on the west, in a slightly singed condition due to the extreme velocity of its movements through the air. In these absurd days, too, when all are trying to be as psychic and silly and superstitious as possible, people got up and trod on other people. Chairs were overturned, and the Lee's policeman ran. How the matter settled itself, I do not know. We were much too anxious to disentangle ourselves from the affair and get out of range of the eye of the gentleman in the lawn chair to make minute inquiries. As soon as we were sufficiently cool and sufficiently recovered from our giddiness and nausea and confusion of mind to do so, we stood up and, skirting the crowd, directed our steps back along the road below the Metropole towards Gibbern's house. But amidst the din, I heard very distinctly the gentleman who had been sitting beside the lady of the ruptured sunshade using quite unjustifiable threats and language to one of those chair attendants who have "Inspector" written on their caps. "If you didn't throw the dog," he said, "who did?" The sudden return of movement and familiar noises, and our natural anxiety about ourselves — our clothes, for example, were still dreadfully hot, and the fronts of the thighs of Gibbern's white trousers were scorched to drabish brown — prevented the minute observations I should have liked to make on all these things. Indeed, I really made no observations of any scientific value on that return. The bee, of course, had gone. I looked for that cyclist, but he was already out of sight as we came up the Upper Sandgate Road, or hidden from us by traffic. The charabanc, however, with its people now all alive and stirring, was clattering along at a spanking pace, almost abreast to the nearer church. We noted, however, that the windowsill on which we had stepped in getting out of the house was slightly singed, and that the impressions of our feet on the gravel of the path were unusually deep. So it was I had my first experience of the new accelerator. Practically, we had been running about and saying and doing all sorts of things in the space of a second or so. We had lived half an hour while the band had played perhaps two bars. But the effect it had upon us was that the whole world had stopped for our convenient inspection. Considering all things, and particularly considering our rashness in venturing out of the house, the experience might have certainly been much more disagreeable than it was. It showed, no doubt, that Gibbern has still much to learn before his preparation is a manageable convenience, but its practicability is certainly demonstrated beyond all cavil. Since that adventure, he has been steadily bringing its use under control, and I have several times, and without the slightest bad result, taken measured doses under his direction. Though I must confess, I have not yet ventured abroad again while under its influence. I may mention, for example, that this story has been written at one sitting and without interruption, except for the nibbling of some chocolate, by its means. I began at 6:25, and my watch is now very nearly at the minute past the half hour. The convenience of securing a long, uninterrupted spell of work in the midst of a day full of engagements cannot be exaggerated. Gibbern is now working at the quantitative handling of his preparation, with a special reference to its distinctive effects upon different types of constitution. He then hopes to find a retarder with which to dilute its present, rather excessive potency. The retarder will, of course, have the reverse effect to the accelerator. Used alone, it should enable the patient to spread a few seconds over many hours of ordinary time, and so to maintain an apathetic inaction, a glacier-like absence of alacrity, amidst the most animated or irritating surroundings. The two things together must necessarily work an entire revolution in a civilized existence. It is the beginning of our escape from that time garment of which Carlyle speaks. While this accelerator will enable us to concentrate ourselves with tremendous impact upon any moment or occasion that demands our utmost sense and vigor, the retarder will enable us to pass in passive tranquility through infinite hardship and tedium. Perhaps I am a little too optimistic about the retarder, which has indeed still to be discovered. But about the accelerator there is no possible sort of doubt whatever. Its appearance upon the market in a convenient, controllable form is a matter for the next few months. It will be obtainable, of all chemists and druggists, in small green bottles at a high, but considering its extraordinary qualities, by no means excessive price. Gibbern's Nervous Accelerator, it will be called, and he hopes to be able to supply it in three strengths, one in 200, one in 900, and one in 2,000, distinguished by yellow, pink, and white labels respectively. No doubt its use renders a great number of very extraordinary things possible. For of course, the most remarkable, and possibly even criminal proceedings, may be effected with impunity by thus dodging, as it were, into the interstices of time. Like all potent preparations, it will be liable to abuse. We have, however, discussed this aspect of the question very thoroughly. We have decided that this is purely a matter of medical jurisprudence and altogether outside our province. We shall manufacture and sell the accelerator, and, as for the consequences, we shall see.
I wonder, what would I do if I had an accelerator of my own? What would I do with the extra time? Spend it at City Hall, I suppose. The Hall of Records can be so utterly fascinating. Do you know, the last time I visited there, doing some research, I had just taken some files up to the salon. The archives don't half give one a chill, you see, and they are these overstuffed chairs by the grand hearth that are so welcome on a cold, foggy evening. Then the mayor walked in on me just as I was about to toss some documents into the fireplace that had incriminated me for... never mind. I'm certain you're not interested in that. Politics are such a bore, don't you think? Oh, must you go so soon? Please, stay and have another bowl. No? Ah, very well. Off with you. I suppose I should be getting on, too. That's all the time this time, or next time, and until that time, what could possibly go wrong?
In this episode, Emerson Lighthouse read The New Accelerator by H.G. Wells, which was first published in the Strand magazine in 1901. Music was written and performed by Kevin MacLeod. Mr. Underby was played by himself. This episode was brought to you by Penny Gap Publications and the Clockhaven Chronicles.
Coming soon to the Clockhaven Chronicles, the exciting second episode in our Day of the Dragons serial. Stanislaus Pulaski's carefree days on sunny Curacao have vanished in a puff of smoke. Threats lurk in the shadows while more loom just beyond the horizon. If that were not enough, he can count on meddlesome friends beside him, beautiful women to beguile him, and situations that will certainly try him. Yet Stan strives to persevere, still determined to build an airship, still searching for answers, still tinkering with his craft, and still mostly clueless. Look for it this spring at pennygaffpublications.com.
Tales from New Babbage was produced by the citizens of the City State of New Babbage for Radio Reel in March of 2013 and is licensed under Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution, Not Commercial, Share Alike. For more information about the show, links to download old episodes, or pictures of our listening parties, visit our archives at talesfromnewbabbage.blogspot.com. Happy Easter, and keep building!